A few months ago, I got a call from the head of Holocaust education at an organization called Sharaka. Founded after the signing of the Abraham Accords, Sharaka, which means partnership in Arabic, creates person-to-person opportunities for moderate Muslims from around the world to come to Israel and Poland to connect with Israelis and gain a better understanding of Jews and our story. It is an incredible organization doing work no one else is doing, creating bonds that transcend borders and beliefs. So when Sharaka invited me to join their delegation to this year's March of the Living, I was delighted. For those who don't know, March of the Living takes place every year on Yom HaShoah, Israel's official Holocaust Remembrance Day, that aligns with the anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, an historic and tragic moment of Jewish bravery and defiance. This is not to be confused with International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which takes place in January on the anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, a historic moment in which an army of non-Jews came upon 7,000 barely alive Jews who happened to be left in an empty death camp the Soviets didn't know anything about. So you can tell which holiday was planned by the Jews and which by the Goys, but I digress. March of the Living brings thousands of people from all over the world to walk the 1.2 miles from Auschwitz, which was mostly administrative and staff buildings, to Birkenau, also known as Auschwitz II, which was the main extermination site where Jews were either gassed to death or enslaved. The march mirrors the death marches the Nazis forced prisoners to walk in the freezing snow from Birkenau to Auschwitz as the Soviet army closed in, so they could destroy the evidence of their crimes and kill more Jews while they were at it. But again, I digress. I was touched and excited that Sharaka wanted me to join them for such a meaningful delegation and for what would be my first time in Germany or Poland. But already having a major international trip planned to Azerbaijan, which I've already told you about on this show, I thought it was probably too much time away from my family. But when I told my wife about the trip, she told me that not only should I go, I had to go. She would hold down the fort with two young kiddos, yet again, so that I could fly thousands of miles away to participate in this important work. Get you a partner like that. Major weekly shout out to Courtney. Fast forward to the 27th of Nisan, the day of the Jewish calendar on which we celebrate Yom HaShoah. After so many years and movies and stories and books and photos, I was finally standing at the gates of Auschwitz. The two things that struck me most about this epicenter of death were its size and its color. So many buildings, so much ground, just a massive operation. I especially felt this in Birkenau, which was shockingly vast. It was also really something to see the place in color, an experience my friend Amy had alerted me to. Shout out to Amy. We only see Auschwitz in black and white photos, but to be there and see its green fields, its deep red brick buildings, the brown of the dirt and mud and wooden train track slats, it jolted the past into the present. This is where it happened, where real atrocities happened to real people. To be honest, I didn't find the march itself particularly impactful. To me, it felt similar to a charity walk. We're all there for a very good and important reason, but the actual activity of the thing is basically chit-chatting with whoever's around you as you walk. Now, imagine it's very different for survivors and their families, of which I am neither. But simply being there, in the place, I actually felt the same way I had when I visited the Nova site in Laim during my trip to Israel last October. In both places, I felt a sense of connection, of almost familial belonging. These are Jewish graveyards. And though the way these people were murdered was horrific and unfair and unthinkably sad, I felt like I was there to honor them, to remember them, to ensure the endurance of their legacy. I felt like I was on hallowed ground, our ground, and there was a sense of comfort in that. But I want to return to the Sharaka of it all, because really this trip afforded me two parallel experiences. One was my first time visiting Germany and Poland, and the other was my first time spending 4 days on a bus through Europe with 20 Muslims. And what surprised me was how much more eye-opening the latter experience was for me than the former. Our delegation was truly eclectic, and I tried to engage with every single person in the short time we had together. I thought I had come to teach them about Jews, and I did, through many different conversations and connections. But by the end of our time together, I realized what I'd really come to do was learn about them. And as I did, I could see assumptions I didn't even know I was harboring turn to dust and float away. There was a large contingent of Moroccans on the trip, most of whom were in their 20s or early 30s. Other than the fact that they're Muslim and smoke an insane amount of cigarettes, there was nothing different between us. Nothing. They could have been any of my friends from home. Thoughtful, compassionate, educated, connected to their religion but not ruled by it, generous, funny, a great hang. I was especially taken by 21-year-old Sheikh Rizki Sherakwai, the youngest Sufi sheikh in the world, a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad himself. He and I made a special connection right away, and he made it very clear to me that Sufism is about the heart and soul and spirit, whether one is Jewish, Muslim, or anything else. He gave me a sort of mantra to pray on, Ya Basir, all-seeing. And when we parted, he promised to be with me in my soul. We also use WhatsApp. One of my favorite moments from the trip was when the Sheikh led the other Moroccans in a spontaneous Muslim singing session on the bus. I swear, it was like being at Jewish summer camp again. Arabic and Hebrew are incredibly similar languages, not just in how they sound and are spoken, but historically and literally in the words themselves. I mean, Salam Aleikum and Shalom Aleichem, that's about as close as it gets, right? And also the energy, the joy, the laughter, the clapping, the ruach. It couldn't have sounded or felt more familiar. There were a number of really smart and interesting folks from Pakistan, Afghanistan, Jordan, and Syria, none of whom I can tell you about because simply going on such a trip is legitimately dangerous for them. Think about that. People who care so much about connecting to Jews, who want to understand the truth about us and Israel and our history so badly, they are willing to do so at great personal risk. Could you see yourself doing that? I spent a lot of time in conversation with Luay Ahmed, a Yemeni ex-Jew hater who, after a lifetime of indoctrination, became de-radicalized when he saw the shocking lack of condemnation for the atrocities of October 7th and realized everything he'd been taught was upside down. He's now an outspoken advocate for Jews and Israel on social media, and he told me that as a liberal Arab, he feels more at home in Israel than just about anywhere else. I also loved meeting Jonathan El-Khoury, a Lebanese Christian who lives in Israel and defends his home proudly, also as an online advocate. And I so enjoyed spending time with Marzouk Abdul-Jami, a gentle and loving 82-year-old African-American imam from Texas, who has devoted his life to traveling the world to bring people of all faiths together. My most meaningful conversation was with the group's youngest participant, a 20-year-old French-Moroccan student named Mia. I look up to Mia. Here's why. At her boarding school in Paris, Mia had a single book of Hebrew on her shelf because she's taken it upon herself to learn Hebrew because that's who Mia is. She has many Jewish friends in Morocco and Paris and feels a real deep connection to our community. When another student saw this Hebrew book in Mia's room, she started getting all kinds of hate as people assumed she was Jewish, including somebody carving a swastika into her bedpost. Did Mia explain to these kids that they were mistaken, that she wasn't a Jew? No. She didn't say a word because she didn't want them to apologize and be nice to her just because they learned she wasn't Jewish. She'd rather them think she was a Jew and dislike her. That's why I look up to Mia, who I think has a Jewish soul, and cried when I told her so. In America, in the Jewish community, in whatever social or political group you are a part of, there are moderates and extremists, and the former usually greatly outnumber the latter. The extremists are just louder. We all know this to be true, and yet for some reason, we are slow to apply this idea to groups outside of our own. We think, I'm a moderate American. Don't judge me by the far-left radicals you see on the news or the far-right neo-Nazi bad guys in the movies. And then we turn around and look at the Muslim world and judge all 2 billion of them by the extremists we see on the news and the bad guys we see in the movies. Not only is it morally wrong to paint every member of a group with the same brush, but we're also making the world a darker place for ourselves when we paint over the many kindred spirits out there just waiting to connect with us. Now, maybe you're one of those folks who thinks, well, if there are so many Muslim allies, why don't I ever hear from them? I want to answer this in 5 ways. Number one, like I said on the show last week, there's the whole algorithm thing. The same way you have no idea what life is like for moderate Muslims in, say, Pakistan, because you don't personally know or follow anyone from Pakistan, the same holds true in reverse. They don't see on their feed what you see on yours. They're not ignoring us. They have nothing to ignore. Number two, As I mentioned, for Muslims in more extremist countries, there can be actual physical danger for openly associating with Jews or Israel, especially right now because of the war. These moderate folks are eager to engage privately and wish they could be more supportive publicly. They just can't. Number three, again, as I mentioned, my new friends like Luai, Jonathan, and Mia are showing up for Jews in Israel, as are many other Arab and Muslim influencers and individuals. These voices exist. If you want to be hearing them, go find them. Just because you haven't yet doesn't mean they aren't out there. And that's true in the real world too. Don't go, "Where are all the Muslims?" if you've never ventured outside your community to seek them out. Why is it only their responsibility to appear at our side in a moment of need if we never did anything whatsoever to build the relationship first? Number four, do you take time out of your life to go online and speak about issues affecting moderate Muslim communities abroad? I'm guessing most of you don't. So why is it fair to assume Muslims are just going to do the same for you? Number five, you would never want to be judged by the most extreme elements of your society. So why would you turn around and do that to somebody else? There is so much more that connects us than divides us. Let this be a comfort to you. We have friends, many friends, who want to understand and love and support us. Certainly not everybody, but enough. Great moments of change have never required everybody. They just require the best of us and the best of them to work together. And that's always been enough to push humanity forward. There's a reason they call it building bridges and not walking across bridges that magically appear for you. I have these amazing new relationships now because I traveled thousands of miles to go get them. Building takes effort, but doing so in sharaka, in partnership, makes the rewards oh so sweet. And I hope one day, if you haven't already, you'll get to experience them for yourself, inshallah. This is the 32nd episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Life's great passions and pursuits has been musical theater, as a performer, a creator, and an audience member. And so it is with great excitement that today I welcome one of the medium's greatest living composers to the podcast. He is, without question, the most prolific contemporary composer of Jewish stories and music for the stage, including two fully Jewish musicals, neither of which is Fiddler on the Roof. He also wrote the musical The Bridges of Madison County, which he called the most Goyish musical he could possibly write. He's got two daughters, three Tony Awards, eight Broadway shows, and he discovered Ariana Grande. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a round of applause to the Meshuggah Maestro, Mr. Jason Robert Brown.
The Meshuggah Maestro. I have to get t-shirts with that.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. You can keep it. I think this is probably the first conversation I've had with somebody I've auditioned for.
That was a long time ago.
It was a really long time ago. Yeah. I don't think that production ever even happened.
It did not.
Yeah.
No, yeah, you auditioned for, we were working on a production of The Last 5 Years to do out in Los Angeles, and then ultimately we ended up not doing it, but yeah.
But now here it is on Broadway.
Indeed it
finally,
is.
Finally, after all these years. Why now?
This was really the passion of Greg Noble, who was our producer. Greg had also been the producer of the revival of Parade after we did it at City Center. With someone you know.
Who could that be?
Another Meshuggah Maestro.
That's right.
And after he did Parade, Greg said, I really want to bring The Last 5 Years to Broadway. And I said, I support it and I'm thrilled for it. And, you know, tell me what you need. But I didn't want to get in the way of it. I've directed the show already and mm-hmm. It's been in my life for 25 years.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like I had anything knew that I wanted to say about it. So I really said, let this be someone else's vision for it.
The lead playing Jamie Wallerstein, Nick Jonas. It's a role that's...
Famous Jew,
right? Yes. So this is a very Jewish role, you know, based on you singing several distinctly Jewish songs, Shiksa Goddess, Shmuel song. Have you heard the criticism about having a non-Jew in this very Jewish role?
Yeah.
And how do you seem pretty nonplussed. Tell me more.
Nick Jonas wanted to play the part, and Nick Jonas is an international pop star who's going to sell a lot of tickets. And you're talking about a show that has to sell a lot of tickets to be on Broadway, and the only way you get a theater is if you have a big star. And the number of big stars who happen to be the right age and Jewish who can really sing this would be vanishingly small. And I believe we did actually reach out to as many of those people as we could, and they were not available or not interested in doing it for whatever reason. And so I liked Nick, and I trusted him to respect it and to do it well. And I said, I want to be clear to everybody that the part is a Jewish character, and that we're not going to not have it be a Jewish character, and that we're not going to make fun of it being a Jewish character, and that is what it is. And other than that, they've been going and playing Jews for, you know, forever. I can get crazy about it, or I cannot. I did not think there was anything inherently disrespectful about Nick doing it. And I thought the only issue is he going to be good or is he not going to be good? And I think he actually does a beautiful job with it. And so the rest of it is entirely academic. It's not, you know, it's not like he's playing Fagin and, you know, we've got him, you know, in Pais and wandering around on stage.
Right.
He's just a contemporary guy who is incidentally Jewish. And we haven't erased any of that by having it played by somebody who isn't.
What do you think about the sort of double standard nature of that? Like, for example, if Jamie was someone in a wheelchair, could Nick Jonas play it?
Well, I don't think being Jewish is a disability.
No, it's not. But it's, you know, it's a difference, right? In some way?
Sure. I mean, I don't know if Nick should play someone in a wheelchair.
So it's a little different. There's something different about it.
I think if the question is sort of what is representation in this particular arena, where is it important for representation to be exact?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Parade, for example, it was very important that that role be played by a Jewish man. And it was, as it happened, and still is on the road. And I just didn't feel that in this case. And I, you know, what I really don't like is when you see people playing Jewish characters who are clearly not Jewish, and what it turns into is some sort of Jewish-y shtick.
That's always the risk.
And there's none of that. And I've seen that from extraordinarily gifted actors. I mean, you know, I've seen it from John Turturro, and I've seen it from the girl in Mrs. Maisel. I like really wonderful actors who sort of fall into this kind of Brooklyn-y thing that I think it doesn't feel real to me.
Yeah.
And so Nick wasn't going to assay any of that.
Yeah.
And I wasn't remotely concerned on that front.
Thank you for sharing that. I know a lot of people were curious to hear your way in. The more famous song probably from the show is Schicksalsgottes, which has been performed by a million people, myself included, for many, many years. But Shmuel's song is more Jewish almost. You know, it's about this shtetl and Klimovich and has this sort of old country European musical feel. What's the story behind that song?
When you get to the Shmuel song in the show, what I needed to do was to demonstrate a bunch of things. I wanted to talk about both who Jamie was as a writer and who Jamie was culturally. And so the Shmuel song is an opportunity for him to sort of express both of those things. This is how I write, and this is culturally where I came from. I think it's obviously Jewish because we think of all those Isaac Bashevis Singer stories in that particular way, and the Chaim Potok and all that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, again, it's not, there's nothing religious at
about
the song. There's just this culture of what it was to be in the shtetls, you know, in Russia, in the Pale of Settlement. And, well,
that's just as Jewish as the religious piece to me. I mean, I think those are
well, precisely, but it's
Jewy.
Not what it's not about is any kind of worship.
Oh, sure.
You know, it's just a cultural history there. And so I think Jamie would have grown up hearing those stories and reading those stories and loving those stories and finding that to be a sort of comforting world of fable.
Yeah.
Whereas Kathy, who he's singing it to, wouldn't necessarily have the same context for it. And
right.
I thought it was important to put the two of them in that situation where he's got this story that feels like this is just my culture. These are my people. This is how we tell this story. And that she would find this all, you know, very exotic and strange. That was the core of the Shmuel song. You know, it was just everything we're going to talk about in terms of Jewish musical theater is going to come down to Fiddler on the Roof at some point. And, you know,
it's the granddaddy.
I remember saying to Sheldon after the show opened, I said, oh, you have to see it. There's a song that you're going to love. And he said, why? Because it's Jewish? And I said, no, because it's a sweet story. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's what Sheldon did so beautifully, you know, better than anybody, is he just told these sweet stories from the heart about, you know, life. And it turned out he was Jewish. And so they spoke in a very specifically Jewish cultural way.
Yeah. I love what you point out about the way that song hits Kathy and that she doesn't really have a frame of reference for. That's not something that I've thought about watching it before. I think that's a really interesting layer.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Parade, which you're currently represented by on a big national tour. It is, for those of you who haven't seen it, it is about the 1913 trial and lynching of Leo Frank in Atlanta, which is a completely true story. It debuted back in 98. Your first Broadway show, you're only 26 years old.
Well, it was 28, but
okay. Oh, sorry. Maybe you started writing it when it was 26, was what I read.
I think I started writing it when I was 24.
Well, there you go. So I hit the mean. So you're brought in by legendary producer-director Hal Prince, who also happens to be Jewish. Take us back, if you will. What was the process of being invited to write a Broadway show with Hal Prince?
It was really wild.
That's got to be crazy.
I mean, it was wild in that it was exactly sort of the pinnacle of what you want to do. I mean, if you're my age mm-hmm. and you grow up loving musical theater, then ultimately you're like, I want to end up writing a show for Hal Prince. That would be like, that's the apex. That's right. The whole thing. And then I was 24 years old and I, you know, had a meeting and got the call and suddenly I was writing a show for Hal Prince. And not just sort of writing a show for Hal Prince, but also writing a show that dovetailed exactly with all the things I was interested in. I wanted to write something that was about justice and, you know, about that sense of, the sense of being judged because your personality is a certain thing. Because, you know, it's not just that Leo is Jewish in the way we tell the story, right. And I think what was true, though, who knows, but it's not just that Leo is Jewish.
He's an alienating guy.
It's just that he's prickly and he's cold, and I think he's a loner and, you know, not a person who loves hanging out with other people. You know, I think there's something that was just distancing about Leo.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with me.
Through in your own personal experience?
Yeah. No, because I don't like people. I mean, who's worse than people?
Cats?
Maybe cats.
Right.
All of those things were sort of on the table at the same time, as well as sort of this great panorama of, you know, what the South was like. And it was everything I wanted to write. And it happened to be that Hal Prince was going to be directing it and Alfred Urey was going to be writing the book. And it would have been overwhelming, but A, I think my ego was big enough to think, well, you totally deserve this. And B, there was just so much work to do that I didn't have time to sort of get, you know, go running around and, you know, cock-a-doodle doing, but, you know, I just had to get the show written, and Hal was a real taskmaster about, you know, we had weekly meetings in his office, and he wanted to see what it was, and he wanted to keep it moving, and he, you know, Hal was a freight train. It was just, there was always motion.
That's so critical to getting these things done. It's, you know, stalling out is like the greatest enemy.
Oh, absolutely.
And then you mentioned you got to work with Alfred Urey, who's like the great American Jewish writer about the South. Tony, Oscar, Pulitzer. What was that collaboration like as the composer lyricist with him as the book writer, which is, you know, a critical collaboration to making the show work?
He was just such a mensch that it's been very hard for me in the, 20, 30 years since then to replicate that experience in any way. He was just the most generous collaborator who Alfred wanted very much to tell this story, which was part of his own family history. You know, his uncle Sig actually owned the pencil factory that Leo worked
in. Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was that person.
Oh, yeah. And Alfred had met Lucille when he was a child. He didn't know who she was, but...
Wow.
So it was very important for Alfred to get the story told. And so he just trusted me to help him tell the story.
How did the revival come about? Where did that come out of?
You know, with Parade, we did the show in 98, 99. I think people went to Lincoln Center or didn't go to Lincoln Center, but they were like, oh, it's so sad. And why would you make a musical about some story like this?
Yeah.
There was a sense also that I have now that it was easy to look, you know, it was during the Clinton administration. It was easy to look at the Leo Frank case as like a thing that happened once. And why do we have to talk about this?
Right. It was the golden age of American Jewry.
Yeah. Maybe, you know.
In the 90s, was pretty good.
And so then 10 years later, we did a revision of the show, and we did it at the Donmar in London.
For what purpose?
Our dance captain on the show at Lincoln Center was a guy named Rob Ashford. And then Rob...
Heard of him.
Rob got to be a very well-esteemed choreographer in London. He had done several shows in London. And so at the Donmar, where he had done some work, they said, would you like to direct? And he said, I do, but the show I want to direct is a show called Parade.
Wow.
And Parade was, you know, the original production was 36 people in the cast or something like that. And the Donmar is exactly as big as this studio, you know, if we could show the camera. But Rob had an idea for how to do it, and it was a great place to do it. And so we did it there, and we made a lot of revisions to the show. I'd say we kind of upended about 25% of the show. And I think I'll be careful about saying this, but London, England in general, doesn't have the greatest track record when it comes to Jewish relations.
Yeah.
And there was something about the perspective of the piece that felt like it was important to say it there. Mm-hmm. And that felt different than when we did it in New York to New Yorkers.
That makes sense.
And so then, you know, years passed, and that version of the show was the one that went out. And then City Center called and said they were very interested in doing the show for a week's run. And they said Michael Arden is very interested in directing it, and Ben Platt is very interested in being in it, and how does all that sound? And I said, well, why would I say no to that? That yeah. sounds great. I said, I want to conduct it because, you know, I love the piece, and I want to make sure it's the full orchestration and that, you know, we take care of it that way. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, we'll do the show at City Center, but we're not going to transfer or do anything like that because people are not going to want to pay to see a show about a lynching. That's not sort of how this works, you know. And I, you know, Benji's great, and I, of course, people want to see him, but they want to see him do something that is life affirming and wonderful and not, you know, sad and tragic. But I think the minute the drums started at the top of the show at the first performance at City Center, I was like, oh, times are different now.
Mm.
I've only ever had shows be unsuccessful on the commercial level. I love the work that I've done. So, you know, I don't try to think of it in those terms. But when I enter the commercial arena, it's generally like, that was a nice try and off we go again.
Yeah.
But what the commercial arena does, other than worry about whether you pay your money back, is it says, this is a bigger stage. You know, if you are going to enter the commercial arena, it's because you're saying, I have something that needs to be on a large stage. And what Greg Noble, the producer, saw was there was a real hunger to put this story on a larger stage. And the context was very different than it was in 1998. The context was, you know, we're in a time where the government, you know, is being run by white supremacists. And, you know, in 2023, that was not literally the case because, you know, Biden was in office. Mm-hmm. But what was all around us was the residue of 4 years of absolutely toxic anti-Semitism. And what was, you know, coming up, though we didn't know it was around the corner at the time, was going to be where we are now.
I want to ask you about that. In terms of the show, like, have you seen the reception to the show change at all since October 7th?
I think what already had happened was that Jewish audiences, and Jewish audiences were always going to be a big part of who came to see this particular show, but Jewish audiences really wanted to see a story that told about what it is to be Jewish in America, mm-hmm. and how the Jew will always be the outsider. But mm-hmm. I think it was so natural and easy to feel, if you were a Jewish person, to feel victimized, to feel targeted after October 7th, that, you know, what we always say about theater or even movies is what you want in the audience is to look up and see yourself, you know? And I think it would have just been so clear and so obvious that, like, we can look up and see ourselves because here's a Jewish man being persecuted because of who he is.
We've had a Last 5 Years movie. We've had a 13 movie. Is there going to be a parade movie?
Well, we'd have to ask your dad. I mean,
I feel like there should be. I feel like it would work great as a movie.
I would love there to be a movie. There have been sort of feints in that direction, but it all comes down to, you know, who's going to star in it. And so I haven't, no one's come to me lately and said, I want to option the movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the kind of handler who goes out there and is like, we're going to make a parade movie and let's do it and let's raise the, you know, right. $65 million it would take to make a small version of it. Right. And, you know, I would have loved to see it, and I still would love to see it. And it might happen.
Yeah, I know some guys. I'll make some calls.
Yeah, make some calls, because it would be nice.
We can get Andrew Resnick to play on the soundtrack. Shout out to Andrew.
That's the most inside moment we'll have on this podcast. A shout out to Andrew Resnick.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, enough people who know me personally also listen to this show. So there's like, you know, there's going to be 50 people who really enjoy that shout out. So I just mentioned 13, the musical, which turned into a movie. This stage musical 2008, movie 2022. This is really one of the great tributes to authentic Jewish joy in the contemporary entertainment canon. Are you aware of that?
I like that description of it.
It really is. I mean, it's a very unique property, and it's the kind of story that I talk a lot about on this show and in my speaking engagements, of the kind of stories I want to see being told, that are contemporary Jewish stories. There's no Jews dying. It's not about the Holocaust. It's people celebrating and being happy that they're being Jewish, and it has meaning for them in their lives.
Well, and I'll get back to an earlier point here, which is that with Netflix, I was absolutely insistent, to the point of I would have scuttled the movie, that all of the Jewish characters be played by Jewish actors. And I think the reason why that matters there, and doesn't matter so much when it's Nick doing it on Broadway, is what we were talking about was, you know, with movies, you're talking about a situation where it is a story about a Jewish kid and a Jewish family, and their Jewishness is absolutely essential to the storytelling. And you talk about a large stage. We're talking about, this is the representation of this show that most people are going to know. Right. You know, this is how this is going to be, as opposed to Nick playing the show for 14 weeks, right, where what I think is I get to see some great pop star, you know, bring this role to life for 14 weeks. Who's being harmed by that?
Right.
I think had the movie of 13 been a bunch of, you know, non-Jewish people playing those roles, that would have been sort of me rubber stamping this kind of erasure of Jewish actors and what that culturally means to the character in a way that I just felt it would not have been at all appropriate to what I had written.
I think that's a super clear distinction. Do you think you could get 13 made today on stage?
I'm amazed that we did it then. That was another show that I never thought was supposed to be a Broadway musical. I mean, it's 13-year-olds running around on stage.
Uh-huh. And in the pit.
Yeah. I mean, it was all bananas. Like, there's a lot of concept around that.
Yeah.
But it's not in any way an experimental show. It is the most sort of like flat out musical comedy I've ever written.
The jock and the cheerleader.
So then Bob Boyette said, no, it should, I want to take it to Broadway, which I think was, I mean, let's say it's about the strength of the material. Let's say it's about, you know, that the music was very powerful. But I think it was also that when you talk about Broadway musicals, you are still talking about a Jewish audience. You are still talking about, you know, it is a Jewish art form. It is a thing that Jews sort of created, and that Jews have been very instrumental in developing. I think less so now, but, you know, oh, well, you know, we get whitewashed out of everything. But do I think that 13 could get done now? I don't know why it was done in 2008. It was, you know, crazy and miraculous.
Sounds like it's been a commercial success for you in its many iterations now.
I mean, I don't know that any of the commercial versions of it ever made any money for anybody. And certainly I don't think the movie did. But in terms of me personally, sure.
Yeah, man, it's been great. It performed all over the place, right? Yeah,
no, it's been successful. And it certainly has been what I wanted it to be. I wanted to write a show that teenagers could do that didn't require them to be grownups. And I just felt like the material that was out there at the time, if you were going to be a teenager playing a teenager, it was going to be tragic. It was going to be like horrible, or it was going to be like really like stupid. And 13 is pretty stupid, but it's stupid in a way that felt very honest to me. It felt very genuine, and it wasn't a story I had seen told.
Of your own bar mitzvah, you said it wasn't, I've read, you said it wasn't particularly traumatic, but also that you had a hard time even finding 10 kids to show up to it. So which is the true emotional truth?
My bar mitzvah wasn't really about me. I mean, as far as everyone that I grew up with and went to school with and went to Hebrew school with and for that, the bar mitzvah was really your parents saying, look what we did. We got him all the way here. Now he's a man. And that was the context for it. So this thing now where a bar mitzvah is basically your wedding, that was not, it wasn't about me so much. I had to learn my Torah portion.
Right.
We'll do all of this. You know, my grandfather was Orthodox. Mm-hmm. My dad's been gone for a while, but my mom is not particularly observant other than that the holidays are the holidays and we have to believe in the holidays. And that's, you know, that those traditions are the things that matter. But it was very important to my grandfather that we do it correctly. And so therefore it was important to my mother that we do it correctly for him. So that was my bar mitzvah. And so the trauma was just, you know, learning how to do it. But the reason I had trouble finding friends, because I didn't have many, but the reason I didn't have, I skipped a grade. I had been moved from the middle of third grade into the middle of fourth grade.
Smarty pants.
I guess. Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't recommend it. It was not.
It's gotta be hard.
It was hard on me. My mother fought against it like crazy, but ultimately the school, it was a public school, and I think they just sort of felt like they didn't have the resources to deal with me.
Yep.
Because I was clearly bored intellectually, and they could sense that. I mean, I knew that, but I thought everybody was.
I can relate. We've spoken a lot about this on the show, and I have ADHD, and yeah. I got into a lot of trouble in elementary school.
So I think they felt like the only thing they could do was to move me up to where I would be more intellectually challenged.
Mm-hmm.
But the social effect of that, I'm still carrying. I mean, you know, it was really intense, and made really clear was if you're a smart kid, then you must think you're better than all of us. And if you think you're better than all of us, then we don't want to have anything to do with you. And so I you know, eventually my way in was the music. You know, that was the thing that eventually brought me into the world again. But for a number of years, I just was kind of looking at everything from the outside and just thinking like, well, I guess I don't get to be part of this because I'm smart. You know, I guess because I it must be true. I must be better than all of you. So okay. That's the trauma of my youth, my bar mitzvah, whatever. By then, that was a long time, you know?
Right, yeah. As part of 13, you discovered some great talent, like you mentioned. Liz Gillies, who I starred opposite in a movie called Spread, which you can find on Tubi about a porn magazine. It's very funny. And of course, Oscar nominee Ariana Grande.
Ariana.
With Ariana specifically, because I know the people want to know. Like,
the people want to know.
Could you see, you know, star power in her?
It's hard for me to take any credit for discovering Ariana because Ariana was going to get there. You know, someone was going to find her. You know, it happened that she walked into my room and my room was the one that had, a Broadway production coming, and there was a producer who was paying for people to show up and do things. And so therefore we were in the right place at the right time. Ari was just an astonishingly gifted singer and just this really wonderful personality. Like she sang maybe four notes and we were like, great, fine. You're looking for talented 13-year-olds. They're like, oh my God, that's what you want. I would say there were very few of those kids who made that kind of impression that quickly.
You mentioned this earlier, but you know, your shows generally have not been hugely commercially successful when they've debuted on Broadway, but the music has been fantastic. What can you share about like that aspect of your career journey of creating great music for projects that maybe aren't received the way you'd hoped and how you keep just pushing forward?
It was really hard for a long time.
I have to imagine.
And it's not now. Mm. It's complicated now because in order to get any new work done, you need money. And people get confused about how to invest in something that isn't necessarily going to pay them back. You know, I think you have to invest in art for the good of the art. If you're just investing in the art so that you can get your money back, that's, you know, fine, great. But I don't really know how to talk to those people. Mm-hmm. You invest in the art because you believe in the art. But the people who fund the art sometimes want to see what's going to come out on the other end of it. So that's the part that's complicated about it. I think I never thought I was writing forbidding or very difficult work. You know, I thought I was writing stuff that was kind of straight down the middle. Like on a musical level, I didn't think I was writing like 12-tone, you know, free jazz craziness.
Right.
It all sounded like pop music to me. I mean, it sounded like the stuff I grew up listening to, which may have been like 12 millimeters to the left of center, but was not kind of like, you know, thrash metal.
What did you grow up listening to?
You know, Billy Joel. I mean, you know, yeah. Billy Joel and Stephen Sondheim and Joni Mitchell and Stevie Wonder and Paul Simon, you know, Carole King. Okay. I grew up listening to singer-songwriters and wanting to be a singer-songwriter. And much of what I was doing musically really did come from that tradition of like, this is what 70s singer-songwriters did and wrote. And, you know, that's what I thought I was going to be, you know. So it was hard for me to be writing stuff that felt to me very kind of accessible and be told that this was so uncommercial and that, you know, people weren't going to want to buy this. Mm. So I spent a lot of time thinking, all right, I've got to keep tacking more towards the center. I've got to be more commercial. I've got, you know, I'll do this thing for kids, or I'll do the Bridges of Madison County, or I'll do Honeymoon in Vegas. I'll do big musical comedies. And I love those projects and I love having done them, but having done them and having them all sort of end up in the same exact boat as the rest of my work, I think, oh, all right, I got it now. You know, if my work were not responded to at all, you know, if I wasn't the kind of person who would be a guest on a podcast, you know, if I just sort of labored in obscurity, that would be one thing.
Yeah.
But I don't. The work gets out there and has a really fervent and devoted audience, people who really care about it, people who really stand up for it, people who really believe in it. And so I now have had, you know, my first show opened in 1995. So I've had 30 years of a career where I know that the work is appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And for me to keep talking about how it doesn't make any money is, you know, I feel like it's just, it's churlish and ungrateful of me at this point. It is an important context for the people who invest both emotionally and financially in my work to understand. And I am now much less willing to tack toward the center than I was even 10 years ago.
Do you mean musically or story-wise when you say
yes?
Yeah, okay. I know you have coming up next season, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. Where does that fall on this continuum of center, outside the middle?
And this was Rob Ashford who called and he said, would you be willing to come into this thing? They'd been working on it for a long time with a bunch of different ideas about what the music should be. And they brought me in and then they brought in Taylor Mack. And I thought, well, if you want to do a show that's me and Taylor Mack together, then you're not expecting it to be Hairspray. You know, this is going to be a really bananas piece of theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we've loved doing it. There have been commercial producers on it. They're the ones who brought me on. So I assume they know what they're getting into. But I haven't spent a lot of time worrying about sort of how to make them happy. Like, oh, we have to change the show so that people will like it. I think I've been like, we have to make sure that the show has the emotional engagement that matters to me.
Sure.
I think we have to make sure that the story makes sense in a way, you know, that matters to me. But that's really me more than it is about sort of the people in Times Square trying to figure out what show they're supposed to see. We were doing Honeymoon in Vegas, which I loved.
Which I saw, by the way.
Yes.
With Andrew.
I loved Honeymoon in Vegas. It was...
Oh, I had a great time.
In a lot of ways, it was closer to me than the last 5 years. But there was a real resistance to it. I could feel it in the city. I could feel it in the houses themselves. And I never knew what it was. I still don't know what it was. Hmm. People didn't like it. And I thought, I'm blind. I'm clearly blind. And on a matinee day, I was walking from the theater to go and meet someone for lunch. And I had to walk through Times Square. And there in Times Square was the Naked Cowboy and all the characters, all the people dressed up as Batman and Pokemon and whatever else the fuck they were doing. And I, walking through that crowd, just shocked for like all of these people, like I could fill my theater 8 times with just what was in front of me immediately. And I was like, I don't want you people to come to my show. If you can't see the show that I see, I don't want you there. I don't, this loud, noxious, bright environment, this is not what I do. This is not who I am. Mm. I don't, if you want to be in the middle of this circus, I don't want to write for you. There is this sort of very shiny, loud, brash world out there that likes to see things as being either one thing or the other, and you are either on one side or that. And I don't want to see the world that way. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to sort of simplify the emotional life of the work that I do to satisfy people who want it to be that.
Your love of Judaism and its music, not just of a narrative style, but also you've written something called the Hanukkah Suite, which is sort of a Broadway classical choral combo of all existing Hanukkah music, which is notoriously not great music. You made it sound a lot better. and then you also wrote the Manischewitz Merengue, which is, you know, Dayenu to a merengue beat.
Well, yeah, that was, I used to do these shows at Subculture for 6 years. I was in residence and I did a show every month at Subculture. And so some, you know, sometimes those would coincide with certain holidays. And Lindsay Mendez and I were doing the show that month, and it was on, I think, the second night of the Seder. That just had been the night that I chose, and I haven't done a second night of a Seder in years. You know, I mm-hmm. used to do them when I was a kid, but I did my first night, and then the second night was the concert. But so I said, well, we should acknowledge the night. And so I had a huge horn section and all of that. And I said, well, we should all sing Diana. So I wrote it. And then I, you know, passed around a bottle of Manischewitz.
Yeah.
This was before COVID. And and that was it. I will say that was probably my most Jewish night at Subculture.
Yeah, the whole audience is singing Diana with you.
Yeah, no. That was definitely a night where you knew who I was.
Do you see yourself as the like primary Jewish mainstream composer of today? Because you kind of are.
I mean, like, I think Bill Finn was certainly more observant than I was.
It doesn't matter. I mean, he's not writing Hanukkah suites and Manischewitz.
Look, falsettos is pretty Jewy.
I don't know. You got a lot more under your belt.
None of it was by design. Like, I never was like, I'm here to represent the Jewish people.
Right.
I don't have any wish to be contrarian about it. I like it. I wish I were a more observant Jew if I was going to be thought of as the Jewish writer. Like, I don't think I kind of have the right to claim that, just because on a daily basis, I'm very aware of being Jewish, but I'm not observant. And I think to separate Judaism culturally from Judaism as a religion, I think is totally fair in society, but I really am separated. I really am a culturally Jewish, and I totally buy that, but I'm not religiously Jewish.
I mean, that is the basis for a lot of what this show is exploring the different ways that people identify and connect as Jewish. And I will say, you know, from sitting over here, I would take somebody who doesn't observe a single law and puts as much Jewish you know, joy and pride out into the artistic world as you do any day over some Orthodox Jew who's not creating the things you're creating.
Right. But I mean, again, what I was raised with is that those rules are there for a reason. And so to not observe any of the rules is to sort of not be Jewish. And I think being an American Jew is very much about having that dichotomy be present.
Sure.
And I think if you ask me what being Jewish is to American Jews, the values, what are American Jewish values? I think there is something to that amount of nuance and empathy, that sense that things can be both one thing and also the other. But, you know, Tevye saying, on the other hand, that to me is the most Jewish value in the world. The on the other hand, what do you see on the other side of it? How can you be so certain and yet also, I see what your point is.
Yeah.
That to me is an essential Jewish value. And when I get really angry at Jews, it's betraying that particular value, betraying that essential empathy. And I have so much respect for Jews who can be observant, who are more observant, who can read the Hebrew, who, you know, who sort of are part of that world in a way that I just never felt comfortable. But I think part of my life story is that I'm never going to feel comfortable in any institution. Wherever you put me, wherever it seems I most logically belong, I'm not going to feel comfortable there. And I think that's true about Broadway. And I think it's true about being Jewish. I think it's true about being a New Yorker. I think it's true about sort of every part of my life. The thing that I most naturally gravitate to and most obviously illustrate, I still don't feel like that's where I belong.
It's a very holistic, astute, you know, observation of yourself.
Well, I'm 54. I mean, I've had a long time to think about it.
Yeah. Recently, we had Stuart Weitzman on the show, who produced a documentary about Jews in Broadway. And he said something like 97% of all Broadway productions have had a Jewish writer or composer. Like, what is that about? Why is it such a Jewish art form?
Well, let's go back to the 20s. Well, you know, what is it that makes the Yiddish theater happen? Why that? You know, there are other theatrical traditions. There are African theatrical traditions. There are, you know, Viennese theatrical traditions. There's something about what happens when you look at, you know, Yiddish theater and what it meant to the community, the way that we expressed ourselves through theater. That was an important way to express ourselves. That was, you know, we're storytellers. To be storytellers that way, to embody those stories so that we get out, we gather a whole bunch of people, we sit them down in seats and we say, this is your story, and we tell it. And there are Asian theater traditions, obviously. There's, you know, British theater traditions, sure. There's all of that. But when you look at the Yiddish theater, which is kind of an amalgam of a couple of different Western and Eastern European traditions all sort of munched on top of each other, it doesn't look different than a Broadway show. And so I think you think about how those people on Second Avenue in those theaters eventually became the people who moved uptown to these Broadway theaters, and they are the DNA of what musical theater, commercial musical theater is, because it came from there, you know, that was sort of what the, and when I talked earlier about sort of how we get whitewashed out of it, I think ultimately anything that makes a lot of money is going to be co-opted by the, you know, by the larger culture.
Right.
And, you know, I think Broadway musicals have been and are being even more sort of co-opted by the larger culture because they can make a lot of money. But I think for a very long time, it was this wonderful little niche that, the reason that 97, I mean, I don't know if it's 97%, but what, who am I to argue with Stuart Weitzman? But if it's 90%, the reason is because we just knew the rules better because we, you know, we made the game. And now it's been, you know, 100 years and other people are learning the rules or changing the rules or doing it or understanding it. But I, you know, it was our game for a long time. It was our vocabulary. And so that's my best guess. So I know you were saying don't put it in a historical context, but for me, it makes sense in a historical context because this is the way our people have always told stories and communicated.
On a personal level, what has drawn you to tell stories in this way through this medium of musical theater?
There's something so elemental about it that in a lot of ways it's hard for me to analyze. I think my natural inclination always was to tell stories. And the minute I put my hands on a piano, I was like, oh, I can tell stories this way. And I saw Broadway musicals as a kid, and I always loved them. I always loved watching them, and sort of what it meant to tell a story with a song felt very, it felt very organic and beautiful to me. And I think the singer-songwriters who I loved, told stories with music. That's sort of what they did. And so I just wanted to do that. There were so many paths that I felt like I could have gone down. I wanted to be a singer-songwriter, and I wanted to be an actor, and I wanted to be a novelist, and all of those things I wanted to do. But the thing that combined all of that the most naturally, again, the place where I obviously belonged, whether I liked it or not, the place where I obviously belonged was just musical theater.
And I've read that you said that your career really took off after you dropped out of college and started working in a piano bar.
It was a place I saw where people liked musicals and where people needed piano players, and I could play the piano. And so I would go in to play for other people and to sing songs occasionally. And then I was writing songs. And so I would say, oh, I can have people sing my songs. And I would give them to everybody just sort of willy-nilly, just hand out my song. Please, you sing my song. Will you do it? And I would be, playing piano for their cabaret act, and they always ended up weirdly with a song of mine in their cabaret act, And I think that intersection of like the Jewish spaces that I came from and the gay spaces that I was in, just sort of people started talking about the work and people started responding to the work. And it was sort of spilling its way out there. And the very first versions we did of Songs for New World were in, upstairs at 88's in piano bars.
That's
and
amazing.
So much of my career is based on the 3 or 4 years that I spent in piano bars. It's where I met Daisy Prince.
Daisy would go on to direct Last 5 Years.
Well, she directed Songs for a New World. She directed Last 5 Years, and she directed The Connector, which we did last year. The sort of the most important creative partnership of my life happened in those, rooms. And Daisy introduced me to her father, who was Hal Prince, who directed Parade. So none of my creative life, the way it looks now, happens unless I walk into 88's when I was 19 years old.
One of the key pieces of advice I give to young kids, and how do I start? What do? I say, just go somewhere, New York or LA, depending on what you want to do. Find a community that speaks to you and just sort of plant roots there and start getting to know people and do your thing and see what happens. And I feel like you're just the total embodiment of that bearing fruit.
I remember somebody said to me, don't take a money job doing the thing that you love. And I understood what they meant. Don't take a survival job as a pianist, on a cruise ship. And then you end up just sort of feeling like you're cheapening what you do. And it just feels like, so I understand that, but I don't agree with it. I sort of think the reason I've ever been able to have a career is because the only way I ever knew how to make money was to just do my art, was to just do it and to make sure that somehow whatever I had to do, I had to get paid to do it. But I had to make sure that the money was, so I played piano bars and I made, if I made $300 a week, that was a good week, but I went and I did it. And I coached singers and I played bad shows and I would have done cruise ships. No one would hire me. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that anything that I can do to make money making music. But because I was so in need, because I was so desperate, I ended up meeting a lot of people who were in the business. People would say, oh, you need a pianist? I know some kid who will fucking do anything.
That's
the
other second piece of advice is when you're starting out, always say yes to everything.
Yeah. I mean, I was in no position to say no to anything. I didn't come for money. I was like, I'm here in New York and I am barely scraping by every single month. Mm-hmm. And so if you need a piano player, great. I have this gift. I have this thing I'm supposed to be doing. And I've spent my whole life learning how to do it. And I'm still learning how to do it. I have to go out and do it. So for me to go wander down to Tribeca to where some like amateur theater group is doing a production of MAME and just say, if you need a second pianist, I'll just sit here all day long. And I, even if I play one note, it's good that you know I'm here. And I did that shit all the time.
I love that. It reminds me, we had an actress, Jackie Tone, I don't know if you know her, on the show, and she is as passionate and committed to acting as you are to music. And she said, look, I'm going to be poor and be an actor, or I'm going to be rich and be an actor, but I'm going to be an actor. And like, I think, you know, that's what it takes to make it in this business. You have to, you can't picture yourself doing absolutely anything else.
Yeah. And I've never felt like I wasn't going to have enough money to eat.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have enough skills as a musician that even if tomorrow, if Broadway shut down, I'm like, no, I still have enough skills. People need enough of what I do. And that was honed over a long, long period of time and a lot of work.
The last big question I want to ask you is, you know, I hear a lot from Jews in the Broadway community today who find there to be somewhat of a hostile atmosphere in the wake of October 7th and sort of the explosion of Jew hatred that we've seen. What do you say to those people who are maybe afraid to wear their Jewishness on their sleeve right now, coming from someone who has, you know, it seems without even giving it a second thought, put that into his art for his whole career?
It's really easy to say, just wear who you are, no matter what it is, if you're Jewish, if you're trans, if you're gay, if, you know, whatever your minority outsider status is, just wear it. Wear it all the time, and if they don't like it, fuck them. It's easy to say it. Totally understand people who don't. And I not only understand, but like, it's fine. You know, there are the people who are going to have the courage to do it, and then there are the people who just don't. And if you don't have the courage to do it, good Lord, live your life. It's okay. I don't like people who are going to deny their Jewishness, but I also don't think you have to sit there with the, you know, the Jewish star on your necklace and the kippah on your head. I think there's a lot of ways to be Jewish in this world that don't necessarily entail advertising it. I'm comfortable advertising it. I'm very comfortable. You know, when I started conducting, I took conducting lessons in high school, and the guy who was my teacher, he said, look, I can teach you a bunch of things. The thing I can't teach you is you're either a leader or you're not a leader. He said, and the reason I'm teaching you is because you're a leader.
Hmm.
And that is a personality type.
Yeah.
You either need the rush of being a leader. And it is a rush. It's hard, but it's a really satisfying thing to be able to do. But you either need that or you totally don't. And so I feel like I don't ever want to push somebody to go against what their body is telling them to do. It's a scary time to be anything. But I'm never going to... I mean, I say it now. Let's say it now. I'm never going to be hiding who I am, because I'm proud of the people I come from. I'm proud of my family. I'm proud of my heritage. I'm not always proud of Jews, because some Jews are assholes.
They're only human.
But I'm proud of being Jewish, because I'm just, why wouldn't I be proud of it? I just am who I am. You know, there's nothing, I'm proud of me, so therefore I must be proud of being Jewish. So I don't have any issue with that, but it's a scary time, and everyone's entitled to be scared. Sure.
I love that I finished with that question, because that was such a great answer. All right, lightning round, and then we'll get you out of here.
Yes.
Challah, rip or slice?
Either.
You go either way. There's no like go-to thing. If I handed you a challah right now, you're gonna rip it or you're gonna slice it?
Well, unless you hand me a knife, I'm gonna rip it.
Okay. Do you have a favorite Jewish holiday?
I suspect I have a least favorite Jewish holiday,
but
I'm probably Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur's a drag, man. There's just no way around it. Yom Kippur's, there's no fun to be had at Yom Kippur. You talk about breaking the fast. Like, you're only breaking the fast because you had a shitty day. It's a bummer of a day. I mean, philosophically, I get it, but I'm not looking forward to Yom Kippur. There's nothing about
it. It's my dad's favorite holiday.
Well, there you go.
Now you have something to talk about at the next workshop.
Yes. Your dad must like suffering. It's not my
Do you have a favorite Jewish food? What's the first thing that pops in
my mother's brisket? What are you going to do? It was great. I will say my Aunt Phyllis also made potatoes. She made these like twice roasted potatoes. And nobody other than Jews would make them. And it was perfect.
Shout out to Aunt Phyllis. If you could turn any biblical story into a musical, what would it be? Joseph's already taken.
A lot of them are already taken.
I guess that's fair.
I'm afraid someone will take me up on it if I say it.
Say it.
I don't know. Esther's kind of fun. I'd get into Esther.
Yeah. She comes up a lot on this show. She's really having a moment.
Yeah. Yes.
That's a good one. You've done Dayenu. You've done Hanukkah Suite. What holiday gets a JRB song next?
Well, given that both of those were accidental, I think I will just let the holiday come to me.
Let the fates decide.
Yes, exactly.
Jason, thank you so much. This has been so awesome. And I know the audience is going to love it. And I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
A standing ovation for Jason Robert Brown.
Except you're sitting.
I can't get up, but you can. Jason, you are literally an inspiration to me in my work, and I've loved having this conversation with you. Folks, next Monday night, May 12th, I'm speaking at Am Shalom in Glencoe, Illinois. Tuesday the 13th, I'm at the High Tech Festival in Manhattan. And Wednesday the 14th, I'm in Scarsdale at the UJA Westchester Celebration. That sounded like an old Borscht Belt joke, but it's all true. We'll have links for everything in the show notes. Please come out. I would love to meet you. Our show is also now available to stream on Izzy, along with thousands of other programs from Israel and the Jewish world, like the new prequel to Shtisel. So check it out on streamisrael.tv. Even if you're watching this, please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow us on the Gram, YouTube, X, TikTok, and sign up for our newsletter at jonahplatt.com. All right, they're playing my exit music. I'll see y'all back here for the next rhapsodic episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt.
Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Livyashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative. Consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I freaking love you guys.